Thank you. First, I'd like to thank the organizers, Mark, Giffre, and Rob, for hosting a great meeting. And I'd like to thank the fantastic staff at the Perimeter Institute who take such good care of us. Work is recent. It sounds very much like what I did a long time ago from a thermodynamic point of view, but this is more statistical and it's quite different in the sense of the old idea was to look at any point in space-time as if it could have been on a black hole horizon and then think about how the first law, the dynamical process form of the first law of black hole mechanics would play out on a locally defined local Rindler horizon. And that was good as far as it went, but it didn't go as far as we'd like, really. And recently, there's been very interesting work that exploited both ADS-CFT holography and also kind of a control on the variation of entanglement entropies in the CFT to derive aspects of space-time geometry, in particular, the linearized Einstein equation around anti-de Sitter space, and even higher curvature corrections thereof. So, but although holography is wonderful and we're learning a lot from it, I thought it would be good if we could get not just the linearized equation, but the full nonlinear Einstein equation. And also, it seemed like the ideas that went into that derivation weren't really necessarily things that could only be applied in the context of ADS-CFT. And the missing ingredient to apply them without ADS-CFT is to focus on very small regions of space-time, just like I did in the old argument with this little local Rindler horizon. So the key to the whole thing is to, you know, remember and exploit as much as possible the fact that around any point in space-time, no matter how quote-unquote strong the gravitational field is, like at the horizon of a black hole, the curvature is actually, you know, bounded by something. So if we go to a region much smaller than the radius of curvature, the space-time just looks flat. In that sense, there's no such thing as strong gravity. But also, there's another thing we have at very short distances, which is that, as far as we know, for any quantum field state in this context of semi-classical quantum gravity, which is the context I'll be talking about, all quantum field states that are, you know, well-behaved look the same at very short distances. So all space-times look flat, all quantum field states look like the vacuum. So the idea here is to make a stationary comparison sort of version of the first law in small regions of space-time, and the thing we're comparing with is just the local vacuum. So we should be able to look at any state as being just a very small, if we focus on a small region, any state of geometry and quantum fields as a small variation of the vacuum. So that's the context of the whole thing. And so I'm gonna just put on this slide the statements that I'll explain during the talk. First, just a purely classical one about the vacuum Einstein equation. One way to say that equation is to say that any small space-like ball, I'll define that in a second more precisely, space-like geodesic ball in space-time of a given volume has the same area as it has in flat space-time. So that statement is equivalent to the vacuum Einstein equation, as I'll explain in a second. And then if we have a source, let's say even in the context of semi-classical gravity, so the source will be a expectation value of a stress tensor, then it's no longer true that the area is the same. There's actually an area deficit. Well, it's a deficit if the energy density is positive. And the deficit is proportional to the expectation value of the energy density inside the ball. And so I'm talking about, well, I'll define in a second what I mean by small. So these are just statements that, you know, are true. They're translations of what the Einstein equation tells us. But I'm going to show in the talk that you can derive them from a principle, which is the principle of entanglement, which is that under some assumptions that I'll tell you, The above is equivalent to the statement that vacuum entanglement in any small ball of a given volume is maximal. So the vacuum is a kind of equilibrium state in that sense, and every other state we encounter so far is just a small perturbation of it. Since the entanglement is maximal in the vacuum, and every other state is near that, and the variation of something that's maximal is zero at when evaluated at the maximum, the variation of the entanglement is zero. And these statements are equivalent to the statement that the variation of the total entanglement entropy is zero. That's the claim. Modulo some assumptions, we'll get to them very soon.
Way to insist that this thing will be flat spacetime identically. It does not satisfy Einstein's equation, but certainly the small ball would have been the same as in flat space because you're sort of fixing it. So what is the...
I actually don't understand the question as you posed it. If I have a gravitational wave, I can't declare that it's flat. It isn't flat.
But you can declare by saying that if it were flat, any small ball would be the same area as in flat space-time.
And I'm saying in the gravitational wave, the small ball will also have the same area as it would have had in flat space-time for the given volume. And if that statement is true for all small balls in the space-time, then the vacuum Einstein equation is true.
But if that space-time was identically flat, that condition would have helped too, but would not have satisfied Einstein's equation.
Flat space-time did satisfy the Einstein equation the last time I checked.
But not if you cut it off halfway through not if it's a continuation of a gravitational wave. It's just, I'm trying to understand the content.
Let's come back to this, because I'm not understanding your question.
Okay, so now
what do I mean by a small ball? So specifically, it's a space-like geodesic ball of a fixed radius L. So you pick a point in space-time, choose a time-like direction. Orthogonal to that, there's a space-like plane. Shoot off geodesics in every direction and integrate the geodesic equation out to some geodesic radius L, and you get a ball. And if L is much smaller than any length scale associated with the curvature, then it's, for the purpose of the first statement I made there, it's a small ball. For the purpose of the whole talk, I also have it be much smaller than the length scale associated with any excitation. So if we had a photon, let's say, with some wavelength, the ball has to be much smaller than the photon wavelength. And this part's the fuzziest, and I'm not sure, and it's really related to a conjecture I'll tell you about. It also should be smaller than any length scale in the quantum field theory that describes the matter. So a mass or even a strong coupling scale or any scale that defines specific physics other than a CFT. So the idea is that the quantum field theory has a UV fixed point, and we get small enough distance scale so that it's sort of in the regime where it's scaling towards its fixed point. Yeah.
But aren't we doing this in gravity? Is the size of the ball smaller than the function?
No. I want to be able to think of geometry classically. So I should have added here that's small but not too small. That's very important.
Have you thought any more about whether that was called for Yang Mills, which is asymptotically very slow?
Yeah, we'll get to that. What precise form? Yeah, it's changed a little bit since you last heard about it. Okay, so let's start with just this geometrical property of space-time. That is that if you can define the area variation at fixed volume of the ball, that means that you could either vary.
So is there some constraint on how I range? Because I could have L be small, but have some crazy boost so that the thing is, L is tiny, but it's like going 1,000 light years away in some frame. Is, Do I have to worry about
I think it has to be in the frame defined by the time-like vector that's orthogonal to the ball. L should satisfy those inequalities. Actually,
right,
we could define those things on the right-hand side invariant. No, they wouldn't be. Yeah, so we'd have to define that in that frame, like the wavelength of the photon in the frame of the ball.
I'm guessing a highly boosted tiny ball probably is still very close to the vacuum state, because I would think that would be like taking a very small pencil on the null surface, sort of.
So, I mean, it's not like if I took a, if I'm in, you know, near a Schwarzschild black hole, which I'm sure Schwarzschild radius, I'm not just supposed to compare L to that Schwarzschild radius, because I could have a ball in that background,
sure,
boosted relative to the black hole, and so that now it's feeling like half the black hole, but it's satisfying
well, feeling,
all the constraints you had on your previous.
Yeah, there should be a local curvature.
So all the curvature scales is just are.
As
RS, that's the only curvature scale in that background. So it would satisfy that. L is much less than RS. And yet it wouldn't be true that it looks like flat space in the neighborhood of that ball.
Would it not?
Wait. No, I think it would. I'm wondering a little bit if I had null curvature, if I could get in trouble. If there's no invariant characterizing the curvature. So let me rely on the frame. I have a frame, the ball defines a frame. Think of every length you can possibly think of in that frame that characterizes the curvature. It should be
so
smaller,
it's not invariant lengths,
smaller than all of those.
In that frame.
That includes the invariant lengths, but there might be others. Yeah. Okay, so then by making a Riemann normal coordinate expansion around the point, we can derive this formula that says that the area variation compared to what it would be in flat space for the same volume is proportional to the Ricci scalar of space evaluated in the center of the ball. So I'm assuming that this constant, this, okay, here's not a space-time scalar, that's a spatial scalar defined once I've got the time direction that defines the ball, and this should be constant over the ball. And so I'm expanding it to Taylor expansion like Riemann normal coordinates, and this is just given by the Ricci scalar of the ball. And the specific coefficient is the area element of a D minus 2 sphere. D is the space-time dimension. L is the radius of the ball. And so we just have this formula. So that's just a true statement about geometry. But it's also true that this Ricci scalar is equal to twice the component of the Einstein tensor that's contracted with the unit normal to the ball, the unit time-like normal. So it's quite interesting, by the way, that you can find this formula in Pauli's book on relativity from 1921 or 22, maybe. Okay, so that's just a fact, but this tells you that if you set this equal to zero, that's the same as setting the Einstein tensor to zero, which is the same as setting the Ricci tensor to zero, so that's the vacuum equation. I just want to point out, and this will be important, I could have considered a different quantity. Let's say, how about the area variation at fixed radius instead of at fixed volume? And then I would get a similar formula, but with a different coefficient. They're related by d plus 1 over 3. And it's going to be actually important, believe it or not, that what I'm doing is holding the volume fixed and not the radius. Something I find a little bit mysterious. Okay, what about this variation of entanglement entropy? Now here the assumptions start coming on. So I'm considering variations of geometry and quantum state of the quantum fields jointly, and the total entanglement entropy in my ball, well, is going to consist of a UV piece that's localized on the surface, an area piece, and I'm neglecting subleading but still divergent terms. And then what I'm calling an IR piece, which is sort of from the bulk of the ball. And of course, the UV piece is infinite in quantum field theory, but I'm going to put in this quantum gravity assumption that somehow quantum gravity cuts off that infinity, and the answer is some constant eta times the area variation. And eta is supposed to be a fundamental constant in this construction. It's universal, it doesn't depend on anything else. And that means actually that I'm measuring the metric in a conformal frame where this is true. this reminds me of Newton's first law, actually, which is really to be understood, it's the existence of inertial frames. It's not that, it doesn't mean anything except when you read it really as the assertion that there exist inertial frames. So you should read this as saying there exists a conformal frame for the metric such that when you measure the area in that frame, eta is just a universal constant. Okay, so that takes care of this piece. This piece, we actually know how to compute for, because the vacuum, we're talking about the comparing to the vacuum state could be written as e to the minus k for some operator k that's been much discussed, the modular Hamiltonian. And just from the fact that it's an exponential, if you write out the von Neumann entropy of that state and vary it, you find that the variation of it is equal to the variation of the expectation value of this operator. So that's not actually assuming anything, that's just true. But I will assume some things in order to be able to evaluate that.
And you don't worry about separating out the degrees of freedom in gravity. How if you pick a region, how do you define that element?
Which you mean?
To define all this.
The hyperspace is a fact, right? So how do you define that element? The gauge theory.
Right. It's just the hypothesis that it exists, and its variation is given by this.
But the assumption is that quantum gravity behaves like a quantum gauge theory.
Enough so that this formula makes sense. Yeah. I mean, there are no. Yeah. I mean, let's see.
In a gauge theory, you can define an entropy such that this is true, and in some sense, it's the natural thing that you expect. Whether you can do that in gravity is nobody knows.
Yeah.
But it's not unreasonable to.
I mean, this is. I'm aiming for semi-classical gravity, not full quantum gravity. The full quantum gravity, I would have to ask, you know, what are even observables and what do I mean by the entropy in a region at all?
Would it include the fluctuations of the metric?
Well, actually, that's an important question that I think the answer is no in here, yes in here. This is something I'm a bit puzzled by, but as you'll see, this ends up being related to the energy momentum tensor, but gravitons don't have a well-defined energy momentum tensor on a scale smaller than their wavelength. But I have to be in a ball that's much smaller than the wavelength. So I don't really know how to even associate graviton contribution to this term. So I just leave it out. And what I end up getting is the full nonlinear Einstein equation. So. But I think that remains to be better understood.
Maybe this will become clear as you go on, but at this point, it's not clear if you can't incorporate graviton fluctuation. Why are you getting Einstein equations? Why isn't this just dynamics of quantum?
Well, why don't you wait and see, and then you'll see how you get it.
Quick question to see if I understand. So it's all finite, right? We're talking about the perturbation was in the same Hilbert space, right?
Yeah, I'm comparing two states, the local vacuum and my different state, having fixed the volume. Okay. Right, so the claim is, right, so if I don't have this term, suppose I'm just in the vacuum of the quantum fields and this is just zero, then the statement that the variation of the total entanglement entropy under this assumption at fixed volume is zero is the same as the statement that the variation of the area at fixed volume is zero. And we just saw that that is the vacuum Einstein equation. So the interesting part comes when we try to cope with this term.
Wait, why would we want that to be true?
Which to be true?
The thing that implies the vacuum Einstein
equation.
Because that's maximal. Oh, that's. Because the vacuum has a maximal entropy.
Actually, that's why we want that. You might be actually concerned about that the vacuum could have, the point is the vacuum could have a stress tensor that's maximally symmetric. And so then we might not want the vacuum Einstein equation in the vacuum.
You mean a cosmological?
Yeah. But that's going to be allowed by the derivation. I guess, is it also allowed once I worry about this carefully? Probably, but let me come back to that. Because we're going to end up getting a cosmological constant, an undetermined cosmological constant.
Okay, one more thing. So far you're giving just one component, or?
No, the whole thing. But that's only by varying over all boosts of the ball. So every ball with in every frame, it has to hold for. Then I get the tensor equation.
And that's still consistent with your conditions on the scales.
It has to be true in all balls that satisfy the inequality, the scale constraint, the size constraint. Okay, so let's first consider CFT case, because that's much more clear, and then I'm going to consider what to do if it's not a CFT. So if the quantum field theory is a CFT, then going back to Hislop and Longo in 82 and derived quite explicitly for all conformal fields in this paper, Cassini, Huerta, Myers, the variation of the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian is related to the variation of the stress energy tensor integrated over the ball, the surface of the ball. And again, under the assumption that it's a small ball, this tensor is constant within the ball, so I can take it out of the integral, and then I just have a geometrical integral involving this zeta, which is the conformal boost killing vector of the diamond and the volume element. So let me just go back to saying what zeta is in this picture. Right, so this diamond admits a conformal killing vector that preserves the diamond. The conformal killing vector is null and tangent to the boundary. The diamond here is just the domain of dependence of this ball. Since I'm taking a first order variation, when I vary the quantum field, I hold the metric fixed. So I'm considering a ball in flat space. Later it will become a maximally symmetric space, but for the moment it's flat space. And so it admits a conformal killing vector whose flow looks like these dashed lines, and it vanishes at this vertex, at that one, and at this bifurcation surface around the rim, and it's tangent to the null boundary. So this is the null boundary is a conformal killing horizon for the diamond, and the formula for that vector field is this one. If you use null coordinates T plus R, which is V, and T minus R, which is U, standard meaning of T and R, you can write zeta nicely as L squared minus U squared D by DU plus L squared minus V squared D by DV. Normalized here, I've normalized it to have unit surface gravity at the rim of the diamond. So I don't normally see it in this form, but if you just re-express it in RT coordinates, it looks like this. And on the T equals zero slice, this term vanishes and T squared vanishes. So we just get L squared minus R squared over 2L times D by DT. And that leads to the formula we've seen a few times already in this integral. C then has just a T component, and the normal to the ball also has just a T component. So we pick out the TT component, which I'm calling not component here. And so we just get the variation of the not component times some geometrical factor coming from doing the integral. Okay, with specific numerical coefficients.
So can I ask a question? So you're assuming that the change in entropy is change in this modular energy, and I think you didn't explain why the two are related?
Yeah, that's actually not even an assumption, it's just true.
That's for why.
The reason is that, so that by definition, modular energy, a modular Hamiltonian was just the log of the density matrix, which has the form of a thermal density matrix. So when we vary it, we just get variation of the entropy is proportional to variation of the expectation value. Let's see. So what happens if we now put in this for delta K and the other term I assume for the UV piece, the variation of the area, and then impose that the sum of the two at fixed volume is zero. Well, then the area variation, remember, I'll just go back to not tax your area variation at fixed volume is proportional to G naught naught with this coefficient. And we have an eta times that. The K variation, we just said, takes this form with this coefficient. And if we take the sum of those and set it equal to zero, and it required that it's true for all unit vectors orthogonal to the ball, so that would tell us all time-time components of these tensors are equal, we get a tensor equation that the Einstein tensor is some coefficient times the variation of the energy momentum tensor, which you can think of as the renormalized energy momentum tensor because it's the difference from the vacuum. And that looks like the Einstein equation, especially if we redefine, if we define a quantity G so that 2 pi over h bar eta is 8 pi G. If we do that, then the relation between eta and G, we just invert it, and we see that it's 1 over 4 times 1 over h bar g. So it's a quarter of 1 over Planck length squared. Now, that's, of course, as it should be, because we were assuming that the entropy was eta times the area. And if it's going to be, if we're deriving the Einstein equation, we should be able to then derive black hole thermodynamics and derive the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy and show that eta better be equal to 1 quarter 1 over h bar g, where g is what appears here. Otherwise, it would be inconsistent. But notice, it would have been inconsistent if I had started with not the variation at fixed volume, but the variation at fixed radius, because the coefficient was different. In fact, I would have gotten eta not as 1 fourth, but as d plus 1 over 12. Now, I find this really puzzling, actually, because I mean, it sort of means that the set of assumptions up to that point is self-inconsistent in this case. If I had gotten this answer, it would have been inconsistent with the Einstein equation that I derived, because I could have gone back and found the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, and it wouldn't have been consistent with my assumption about the entropy. So it seems either deep or trivial, and I'm not sure which, but that it's not, that I really have to take fixed volume.
Yeah. I'm a bit confused.
Well, I'm talking about the conformal field theory case here.
But the region you're having has gravity. So why is the, is there, are you assuming that the fixed conformally invariant fixed point for gravitational field?
Gravitational dynamics, like we were just talking about earlier, is not playing any role here because we're so small that we just have flat space. So
then why do we recover Einstein equation?
Well, we consider a joint the generic variation away from the vacuum varies the metric away from the vacuum metric and the quantum fields away from their quantum vacuum state. But since we're only looking at a first order variation, the general variation of S is a sum of two terms, one from varying the geometry and one from varying the state of the quantum fields.
But the state of the entire theory is the state of quantum gravity.
Yeah, but somehow, because of the nature of gravity being not localizable completely. In fact, I'm ensuring by the smallness of the ball that I can't capture any gravity contribution on the coming from the modular Hamiltonian. It's actually related to your other question about observables in gravity. This would be one of them, is the energy density of the gravity I can't capture. I mean, this is just what I've done. You could say you're just kind of assuming what you need to make it work. And we can explore that. Like, is there some better way to justify not including gravity among the quantum fields whose entanglement entropy is changing in the bulk?
But to define entanglement entropy, you need to not tell me what the state is.
Yeah.
So in practice, we're
just completely leaving out gravity, or Actually, I think there should be probably a way to understand this by not leaving out gravity, but taking into account gauge invariance. Oh, in fact, that's right. I had a nice thought about that last night. I anticipated this kind of thing. So probably if we're really careful about gauge invariance, hopefully there would be a more less arbitrary sounding way to justify omitting the graviton contribution. But certainly I couldn't make sense of it if I tried by this method, because its stress tensor isn't even well defined at that scale.
So if D equals 3, you get the right answer.
D equals 2.
D equals 2, yes.
Yeah.
D equals 1 equals 2. So yeah. I guess that's just the length and the volume are the same.
So I mean, even in ordinary thermodynamics, you never expect entropy to just be extremum for any variation. You fix some things, like
right.
fix energy of a system, for example, and second, fix energy when you maximize entropy. So I guess you must have an equivalent statement here, is that this statement of maximizing entropy
yeah.
must be at fix something. And then the question, what is the thermodynamic equivalent of that?
Right.
So
if you were talking about the usual free energy of like a gas,
right.
it's minimal in equilibrium, which means that the entropy is maximum at fixed volume, though. It's minimum at fixed volume, sorry. The Helmholtz free energy, or am I talking about the Gibbs free energy, mm-hmm. is each free energy is associated to one parameter you're holding fixed.
Right.
So if I want the entropy to be maximized, of course I better hold the volume fixed, if you're talking about a gas.
Yeah.
It's not so clear in this setting what I should hold. It's reasonable that volume seems more extensive than the radius.
That makes sense.
You know, it's not like a derivation of it, but it's
usually,
reasonable.
Sorry, usually you maximize the entropy in a microcanonical ensemble where you're fixing the energy, not in a canonical ensemble where you're talking about free energies.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, I also have an argument about this in the paper. In a sense, the energy that's relevant in this case is zero. So
okay.
that's why the free energy just becomes minus the entropy. It's like the diamond is a miniature cosmology, like a static patch of De Sitter space, which has no associated energy. And rather just maximizes entropy. At the end of the talk, actually, I want to come back to this question of, do we have any reason to believe it could actually be true that the entropy is maximized in a small ball, just from other grounds, like in the vacuum?
I mean, but
let's not get hung up on it right now.
But I mean, it sounds like what you're maximizing, maybe the way to say it is entropy per unit volume. Right, that's an intensive quantity, which
well, but
makes
it's,
sense to maximize.
It's the entropy in a ball. Like per unit volume of the ball. But I mean, it's localized entropy. It's not like a gas that has entropy independent of its localization. Okay, so let me continue, I guess. I don't want to run out of time too badly. So this covered just the conformal field theory case because I used this result, which came from conformal field theory. And clearly that is not good enough. So what do I do if it's not a conformal field theory? So initially, I made a conjecture, which was that I should basically replace T naught naught by the naught naught component of the trace-free part of the stress tensor. And then I realized two things. First of all, it's probably not true, as I've been told by some people looking into it. I'll show you in a second. And secondly, I don't need it to be true. What needs to be true for me to proceed, actually, is that instead of just having T naught naught, I have in addition some scalar operator I'm calling X. So it's some scalar operator. Maybe, in fact, there's evidence it's if I make it proportional to the trace of the stress tensor, that could actually be a true equation. So this is the biggest assumption from my viewpoint that's unjustified so far, but it's currently under investigation. Suppose it were true. Then what would happen in the derivation is, of course, I'd have some x correction to the variation of t. Since I'm going to write it in a frame-independent way, I'll put in the not-not component of the metric there, which is 1 in that coordinate system that I was using when I wrote not-not. And therefore, I would just get an equation like this. So an additional term which is proportional to the metric. And this might look sort of good, but it's actually a big problem. It doesn't work because it implies a constraint that the variation of this expectation value is constant in space-time. And for instance, if x were proportional to the trace, that would imply the trace is constant, and that's too strong a constraint. It implies that just by the Bianchi identity and the conservation of TAB. We take the divergence of this equation, we get zero here by Bianchi, zero here by energy conservation, and so we get that the gradient of that is zero. So there's really a problem here, and something has to be changed or the whole thing fails. So faced with this, eventually I hit on the idea that what I should change is the assumption that that the vacuum I'm comparing to is flat space. Because actually, any maximally symmetric space-time seems as good a candidate for a vacuum as flat space does. When I'm talking locally, I mean, I can't talk about the total energy being zero, for instance, and distinguish them. So what I'm gonna do now is allow my space-time in the vicinity of my ball to be that I'm comparing to be a maximally symmetric space of a scale that's a priori not determined. I don't know what it is. And so to do that, basically in my formula for the area variation at fixed volume, instead of having the Einstein tensor, I have the difference between it and the Einstein tensor of my maximally symmetric space. And that is some constant within the ball, but maybe not a constant in space-time, times GAB. Now, if I do that and replace this G by this sum, I'll come back to that. Then I get this equation. And now if I take the divergence, I get that the gradient of little lambda is proportional to the gradient of delta of x. In other words, this combination, actually, this is not right. I need this coefficient here. So some linear combination of those two should be constant. So therefore, they basically cancel each other up to a constant, is what I'm saying. That's the only consistent. So consistency with Bianchi and energy conservation tells me that lambda and delta x combination is constant, and therefore that I just get the Einstein equation with an undetermined cosmological constant lambda.
Wasn't the small lambda also a constant?
So? No, it was a constant within the ball. But I wasn't biased. The role it was playing was I was comparing my local state to a local vacuum state. I just didn't know which local vacuum. And what we're learning is that which local vacuum we're comparing to can vary from point to point in space-time. It's like if you were looking at an equilibrium configuration that had a different temperature in different places because it was in a gravitational field, let's say. And so you'd have to allow the temperature to be position dependent, but then you're examining equilibrium on a scale small compared to the gradient in the local temperature. And
so this is a very particular definition of vacuum because, like, say, in equilibrium space-time, the correction to GAB, I mean, it wouldn't be lambda GAB, it would be something that's not proportional to GAB, for example.
Right. So, but the idea is that what deserves to be considered as a vacuum is a maximally symmetric space. So if it looks the same everywhere locally and in every direction, that seems like what you would mean by equilibrium. It should be, local equilibrium. And then I'm just saying that local equilibrium could change from point to point, just like it could in a fluid or...
Right, but I guess I'm just saying it's ambiguous what it is. Like if you live in an FRW space-time, what is
the local? FRW is not maximally symmetric.
I understand. So I'm saying if there's a local observer who lives in an FRW space-time and wants to define his or her local equilibrium vacuum, what would it be?
Oh, I'd have to know in each case what x is and what its expectation value is to work out backwards to find out which maximally symmetric space I was comparing to.
Isn't it related to the trace of the stress tensor?
It's probably, but I'm going to say it in a minute.
So there's a formulation of Einstein's equation, which is V double dot over V equals the trace of this transcending intensity. As well.
V being a free fall volume of of a ball of dust particles. Yeah.
Yeah, or something like this. So maybe you can't access that part because you're keeping this volume fixed.
Well, this is a static comparison, so it's probably it's related, but that uses the Rache-Oduri equation, so it's just a different way to characterize the geometry.
I got very confused on two things here.
Mm-hmm.
Why is X local? K is not local.
Well, everything is local because remember the ball is small enough that I'm assuming we're just talking about the total variation of entanglement entropy in this small ball. In the case of T, it just came out the value of T and saw T naught naught in the ball, which is assumed to not be varying over the scale of the ball. So I'm just assuming there's some operator X of a similar nature.
But is that true in one?
Well, we need to know if it's true. It's a conjecture. I'll tell you right now.
For holographic theories, then X is T for non-conformal.
Well, so let me just tell you the one thing I know, almost know, I don't know. So this is being investigated currently by Anthony Speranza, who's a Maryland student, and Damian Galante, Cassini, and Myers are also working on it with a different approach. And both of them have some preliminary results, so they shouldn't be held responsible for this at this point. But they both got the same preliminary result, which was that if you consider a deformation of a CFT by an operator of dimension capital delta, that formula that I showed is true with the interpretation that delta, whoops, this shouldn't be here, that delta of X is in fact proportional to delta of the trace of the stress tensor with this coefficient. If this term hadn't been there, it would have actually been the trace-free part, which is what I conjectured, but apparently this term is there. Of course, this is just a single operator defining it, but hopefully, as we go on, we could learn more about quantum field entanglement variation in small balls and either show that it's true, what I'm assuming, or that it's not. But the nice thing about it, it's just a question about quantum field theory. It's not a question about quantum gravity or gravity even.
So this formula assumes deformation away from CFT, but still small volume.
Perturbative, yeah. Small volume and perturbative deformation away from CFT.
Calculation holographic or?
Both of them have some holographic aspects, but they're one is fully holographic actually. The other one uses conformal perturbation theory methods and holography. Hopefully that they'll be finished soon and we'll have a definite answer. Whoops. What happened? I think.
Sorry.
Yeah. I'd like to thank the organizers. let's see. Right, so I already said this. Oh, good, that is the end. So I can tell you the really end. Okay. So that's the end of the part that's on slides. I did want to talk about the question, is it possible that it's really true that the entanglement entropy in all small balls is maximal in the vacuum.
Can we back up for a second?
Sure.
So then, since presumably we wanted to get the Einstein equation with cosmological constant, even with a CFT, I mean, possible couple of CFTs.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Einstein gravity with the cosmological constant, I presume.
Right.
Your original CFT derivation was actually too restrictive.
Exactly. So I think I should have gone, when I. Exactly. I told it a little bit like a detective story, but then I forgot to tell you that's what I was doing. So I started with the preconception I should compare to flat space. I ran into a contradiction. I didn't anticipate the contradiction that you just said, but I ran into one for a non-CFT. The only way I could see to fix it was by comparing instead to a maximally symmetric space that I didn't know a priori. And now that I've figured that out, yeah, I should have allowed for that in the first place, even for a CFT. So then I would get an undetermined cosmological constant. So it's really that the vacuum, you know, maximally symmetric space is just as good candidate for equilibrium as a flat space.
Okay. but it ends up being a fixed maximally symmetric space.
In the case of a conformal field theory, yeah, that parameter lambda has nothing to combine with to make a constant, so it has to be a constant by itself. But if I have non-conformal matter, there's this scalar piece that also is not constant, whose sum with the lambda piece has to be constant.
I assume it's the same cosmological constant on this auxiliary reference state.
No. The one you end up getting is completely arbitrary integration constant.
Oh, I thought you got. Oh. Okay.
So you're comparing it with a different reference state at every point?
Yes.
Wouldn't it have to do with the new modular population of gravity where you have a constraint on the determinant?
Yeah.
Then you lose some of the gating
drives
and you left.
Yeah, I played around with that a little bit and tried, I couldn't get anything different to come out of it. Yeah. Okay, so let me try to briefly address the question. So I just assumed the entanglement entropy was maximized in the vacuum, properly understood, at fixed volume. Or if you wish, what I really assumed was that formula of how I interpreted that statement. But let's ask, could it be true that, you know, that the entanglement entropy really is maximized in these small balls? So you might think the answer is obviously no, because let's take a piece of the vacuum in a small ball and just say, well, it's vacuum. I could just take an entangled pair of particles and stick a particle inside there. It's entangled with something outside and make more entanglement entropy. But the problem is I can't do that. It seems like I can't do that. So the argument would be something like two-step. First of all, if the particle was going to be adding a bit of entropy, but it's localized within this diamond, it has to have an energy uncertainty at least 1 over the radius of the diamond. But that energy then, sourcing Einstein's equation, would make an area deficit contribution. And the area deficit, if you calculate it, would mean that you would lose 1 bit of area entropy to pay the price for gaining the extra bit that you got by putting the particle in there. And then you could worry, well, what if I put a particle in that has a huge number of internal states? Couldn't I then do it? Because then the energy of what I'm putting in is unrelated to the entropy of what I'm putting in. But actually, that's not true. Thanks to the paper on highly entropic objects by Marilf, Minich, and Ross, we know that if you actually have a thermal, so it's a thermal bath in the diamond, right? The state of the field in the diamond is thermal with respect to the modular Hamiltonian. If you let me think for a minute about conformal fields, it's really a thermal state with respect to the boost Hamiltonian, the conformal boost Hamiltonian. And if I have particles in the world that have a huge number of internal states, those also live in the vacuum in my diamond. And so the thermal entropy of my diamond is already very big. So when I look at the change of entropy by putting in this extra particle, in fact, it doesn't scale with n, log n, where n is the number of internal states, it's just given by the Clausius relation, namely the variation of entropy is variation of the energy or modular energy divided by the temperature, which here is like the unruh temperature in the diamond. So this is, you know, it's hand waving, but it has the right ingredients to suggest that actually it really could be true that the vacuum maximizes the entanglement entropy.
I just had field theory on fixed space time without gravity.
Yeah.
Then there are states with more entanglement. Right?
Sure, just put more energy in. It's the back reaction.
This is somehow a statement that you can't like turn on gravity a little. It sounds like there's some.
I can't turn on gravity?
I mean, you might have then said, well, now just turn on gravity by such a small amount that it doesn't affect the metric much. And I mean, if it were sort of continuous
Like I might have tried to go to a state.
The problem is that the area contribution to the entropy goes like 1/g, so it diverges at g equals
right.
zero.
I mean, there's sort of an interesting statement about not being able to turn on gravity.
A little bit for this right. analysis, yeah.
No, but the original thing was infinite when you turned off gravity. That's his way out. It wasn't finite to begin with. When you turn off gravity, he has no cutoff.
Yeah.
So everything is infinite.
Okay, I see.
That's all I have to present so far that I've thought about semi-coherently, but so it'll be interesting to see if the conjecture is actually true about quantum field theory. I mean, it could totally fail on that, but if it doesn't fail there, it seems very suggestive I think I should stop there.
There's plenty of time for questions. Veronica?
And I wanted to, since you're taking such small regions, how would you distinguish between Einstein's gravity and high-gravity theories of gravity from what you have done so far?
I think I would have to put in, and this would be an interesting thing to try to do, instead of just dropping the subleading terms in the area for the surface contribution, the UV contribution to the entropy, I should include the next to leading order. That could include curvature correction, log correction, or depending on the dimension I'm in, some less divergent piece. And if I did that, then I would also have to carry out the Riemann normal coordinate expansion to a higher order and take that into account when I calculate the area variation. And the whole calculation would have to be uplifted to the next order. And that sounds like a hard but interesting thing to try to do.
Good. So far, nothing is distinguishing.
Right. It's just supposed to be the leading order. It would be a problem if you could somehow manage to cook up a consistent gravity theory that had no area term at all in the entanglement entropy. I think actually Sol Dukin told me about such a theory. Well, it wasn't clear it was consistent, but a gravity theory where that happened.
Like a pure Gauss Monet?
Yeah, something. It was a curvature squared. And then there's a question of, is the setting consistent? And if it is, then that could actually be a conceptual inconsistency in the derivation.
Meta?
At one point, partway through, you made an assumption about how the change in the entropy was expressible in terms of an ultraviolet piece and an infrared piece.
Yeah.
What makes you think that there's a really clean separation between the quantum gravity degrees of freedom and the other degrees of freedom in the system?
Good
because
question.
Because in a lot of contexts, that assumption is probably wrong, I think. I don't know, but if mm-hmm. we could come up with a better controlled understanding of how you
yeah.
can separate those cleanly, between, say, gravity and non-gravity degrees of freedom, I would find
right.
it more convincing.
So one thing that's tied up with is that other question that we hit a couple of times on gravity and gauge invariance, but there could be other issues also. I just agree with you. It's not completely clear.
I don't have a solution either.
I just assumed it, and it seems to work, so maybe there's something to it.
Well, maybe that teaches us something about the assumption.
Right, and maybe you don't need full quantum gravity to understand it better than I understand it now. I mean,
I guess that's actually what my question was. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, go ahead.
In this limit, although you take a small ball, is it still possible to think of forming a small black hole and then watch the black hole evaporate in this small ball?
No. Because that would certainly have variations in the metric within the ball that are not encompassed by this analysis.
You don't require this ball to be comparable with Planck scale.
No, I want it to be longer than that, but shorter than those other lengths.
So this condition you want to be true in every frame of reference? is it sufficient to have it true in just a finite number of references, say 10 appropriately chosen? It will work as well.
Right, because you're basically saying, if you have a tensor whose TT component is zero for enough TT vectors, like you said, 10, that's probably enough.
And in that case, do you need to think more carefully about the Lorentz transformations or what's happening there? I mean, is there something especially, is the speed of light coming in as well? Could you use some of the kind of transformations like Galilean transformations? Is it really?
Well, I didn't go back and try to think of the whole thing without assuming. I mean, the starting point is local Minkowski metric describes every space-time. So I'd have to start from scratch and think about it again in a Lorentz violating setting. It would be interesting.
So I guess I have a question. Say I had a field theory which is cut off in some other way. I just put a cutoff in a field theory somehow. Does your thing then, does that now give me a way of associating a metric to a field theory state by finding, I mean, you could ask what now, is there a metric so that—
Oh, well, can I interpret your question differently?
Okay.
You mean so that the area term would give the entropy? Is that what you have in
mind? Well, I mean, you say, I can now go around and compute the entanglement entropies of various volumes, and I'll get a finite answer.
Well, comparing them to the vacuum. The finite thing is the difference between the vacuum and that. Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, I get an answer, but then I could say, well, is there a metric where where that would be constant everywhere for the, you know, where every—
Right. Yeah. Of course, I don't know, but you raised the point of, which was one of the ones I was thinking of making. So if you like the idea, which I think you do, that maybe the origin of the metric and even the structure of space-time itself is entanglement, then maybe you can get the metric in terms of entanglement. But actually, normally I would have thought, yeah, maybe you could get that far, but if you look at the Einstein equation, it also has another side, which is the energy momentum tensor. And you're not going to get that from entanglement. But actually, in this derivation, you get both of them from entanglement. I mean, the right way to understand the source of the Einstein equation here is as just some change of entanglement entropy. So both sides are entanglement then. And that just seems beautiful and kind of pretty compelling. So is there this theory that we're sort of starting to vaguely see through the mist of a pre-geometrical theory of space-time from entanglement? It sure seems that way, but it seems like we must be pretty far from it still.
But how does
somebody else?
Was it coming before me?
I didn't even give you a nasty look.
Well, mine is a follow-up, a direct follow-up. So, I mean, but then how does this connect to Marx's derivation of the Einstein equation in the holographic marketing company, in the holographic? What you started with. Is there a special case of yours when you sort of interpret it right, or it doesn't sound like it?
Actually, it might be, because by conformal symmetry. Oh no, but the Einstein and the Bolzmann.
So the thing that I did with Brian, which included semi-classical stuff, was like a big version of what he did. We had an expression for the modular Hamiltonian of a whole Rindler ADS wedge, and there's some similarities, but
isn't the CRT here defined given the dimension of the bulk?
Sorry.
The CRT you talk about is defined in the same dimension as the bulk, which is different.
Well, with Brian, we considered quantum fields in the bulk.
In the bulk.
I mean, it's different. I mean, they're similar elements, though. So we were considering quantum fields in the bulk, and those as corrections to the bulk entanglement entropy.
Actually, let me follow up on that question. But I might have thought that if you did the holographic computation, you would get the right dynamics of quantum gravity, whatever that is. Whereas here, there's an assumption that, I mean, we don't know what that right dynamics is, but whatever that dynamics is defined by the field.
Whereas I don't believe
defined by the field theory.
Yeah,
no, no, because there's the whatever you assume about the surface contribution.
No, in the holographic context. In the holographic context.
Oh yeah.
Whereas here, I don't believe that Einstein gravity is then defined by the quantum theory.
Right.
So getting this is just an approximation.
Right.
Whereas Marx's derivation will give you something that's on the nose of quantum dynamics.
Well, but it's still in a regime where you're not probing much of the structure of the of that full quantum gravity theory.
But if you could do that derivation for arbitrary shapes of boundary regions, you would.
And beyond linear order.
Okay, so maybe we should continue discussing in the break and come back at 4 and thank Ted again.